Hello, Village. You're listening to Heal, Grow, Thrive, the podcast hosted by Forward Promise. If you don't know us, we're social change advocates focused on reclaiming the humanity of boys and young men of color and supporting the villages that nurture them. In our podcast, we'll talk with direct service practitioners, young people, researchers, and leaders in philanthropy, offering a deeper understanding of both the issues facing boys and young men of color and quality solutions for their healing, growing, and thriving. Thanks for joining us. So hello, everyone. This is Dr. Rhonda Bryant. Welcome to another episode of Heal, Grow, Thrive, the podcast of Forward Promise. I'm joined today by an old friend, Dr. Taquan Stewart, who is an educator of 29 years with a passion for many, many things, the opportunity gap in science, issues related to urban education, culturally sustaining pedagogy, and ending the school to prison pipeline. From 2007 through 2012, Dr. Stewart served as a secondary principal in South Los Angeles. He currently serves as faculty advisor for the Cal State Teach and Los Angeles Urban Teacher Residency programs at California State University, Los Angeles. In addition, he serves as program director for Project Youth California, which is a nonprofit organization designed to provide educational services to underserved youth in the Los Angeles metropolitan area. As a teacher educator, Dr. Stewart stresses a humanizing pedagogy. So welcome, Taquan.
I'm here. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, absolutely. I'm just grateful for social media so we can stay connected and I can keep up a little bit on the work that you're doing. And I'm glad that we get an opportunity to talk today.
Definitely. Well, I can't let you get away with saying that without saying that I am extremely proud of the work you're doing. And actually to prepare for this, I just put a string of bullet points together so I could, have some talking points to refer to or to lean on. And actually a couple of those bullet points came from something published by the Mariah Group. So definitely keep it up, keep up the good work.
Thank you, I appreciate that, I really do. So I wanna go back to the last thing that I mentioned in your bio. As a teacher educator, Dr. Stewart stresses a humanizing pedagogy. And that really struck me when I read it because it's so completely aligned with the work of Forward Promise. So one of the goals of Forward Promise is to disrupt the dehumanization that happens every day in systems that touch the lives of kids of color. We focus on mental health systems, juvenile justice, child welfare, and the education system. And you and I both know, you know, while education is touted as this great equalizer and the pathway to the American dream, that's not the reality for our young people because the education system just has so many flaws. And the system really just hinders their ability to access education fully because it strips away their humanity every day by giving them these subpar school buildings, either eliminating or denigrating their cultural identity in the curriculum, denying them their education through these subjective discipline policies, and criminalizing them by engaging police in the schools. So today, we're gonna focus our conversation specifically on school to prison pipeline issues and this piece about criminalizing young people of color in schools, because in theory, schools are supposed to be a safe and nurturing place for our kids, right?
Yes.
So, but before we jump into that, I want to ask you just to tell our listeners a little bit more about yourself because you didn't start out in education. After undergrad, you worked for the military, right?
Yes. Having an undergraduate degree in physics, I worked briefly, continued through an internship and worked briefly after graduation in interior ballistics. Worked as a civilian contractor with the United States Army down at Aberdeen Proving Ground, Maryland. Did some good work, which is now declassified. And if you like reading some kind of technical erudition, you can go find that online somewhere if you want. I don't read it. So, but did some work on an interior ballistics. And then just real straight to the point, just one day was looking at the wall in my office and said, what am I doing at the end of the day? What am I contributing to? And I couldn't see it. And I left.
Wow.
Left. That simple. To save all the gory details, I started teaching about a month after I left.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, that was 1991. Yeah.
And so what took you to California? Because you're a Delaware native. You started teaching in Delaware. What made you choose California as the place where you wanted to make an impact?
Well, as you would definitely recall, I used to do stand up.
Yep.
So, I did stand up while I was teaching. But at the same time, a lot of people don't know, I moved very quietly around Wilmington, did certain things working with youth. I coached, tutored and mentored and did stuff like that and stayed in contact with some of the mentors I had growing up and dealing with some of the programs they were doing, starting some of my own programs. And so that was always there. So I never really was not dealing with youth. And so, it wasn't out of the ordinary where I would run from Aberdeen Proving Ground or from Glasgow High School or Christiana High School and then coach under the bridge right at 4th Street and then go do stand up at night or whatever. And so I decided I kind of wanted to pursue stand up and that's what had me come to Los Angeles.
Okay. So what brought us to our interview today was a chapter that you wrote in the book Transforming Practices in Urban Education that was published back in 2014. And your chapter, which was entitled Care Syndrome from Social Institution to Caring Institution, you shared your approach to reducing this need for police presence in the school that you were working in, and how you created a new culture at your school in South LA. So, for the last several years, there's been a lot of advocacy nationally and locally about ending police presence in school as a means of ending the school-to-prison pipeline. And in the wake of George Floyd's murder, police-free schools has again become a huge rallying cry around the nation because people understand that the abuse that George Floyd suffered can and does happen inside some of our school buildings, and that our young people are at significant risk. And there are a few school systems that have voted in the last few weeks to now sever those ties. So, what's your take on all of this momentum that we're seeing right now?
I think people are finally fed up. And to be truthful, I must go back and lean on the law legal scholar, Patricia Williams. And I don't know if you're familiar, but she termed, or she coined the phrase spirit murdering or spirit murder. And she coined that term in response to a legal response to racial discrimination. So if we break that down succinctly, what it is it's better to be safe than to worry about discrimination, right? And so the spirit murdering happens in our schools every day. But what we saw was the physical in that 8 minutes and 46 seconds that happens both psychologically and spiritually every day in schools. And so, for lack of a better way to say it, it trickled down. Because if we go back to ancient Kemet, the psyche is the actual soul or the spirit. We say psychology is the study of the mind, but the psyche, if you go back, is the actual soul, the spirit. So therefore, we come back to the spirit murdering that people are noticing. I think is a bubbling up. It's hard to pinpoint, but I definitely think it was a bubbling up. And then finally, people begin to realize what racism was. It's not these one-offs by bad actors or bad apples. And then on top of that, we finally began to acknowledge how racism is really institutionalized and how it breeds and maintains that physical or spiritual violence.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I'm so glad that you raised that, because people need to understand that whole cultural frame around it all. Mm-hmm. And not try to talk about it in 2020 terms as if this is something new, when we know that this has been happening to our young people for generations within the school system.
Yes.
So let's dig into your experience at your secondary school. First, describe for us the student body and the community that the school was located in, just so people have a sense for the kinds of issues that you were grappling with in your building.
Okay. Well, let's go back to something we're both familiar with and then fast forward.
Yeah.
You know, me being from Wilmington, most people don't even know this, but in 2014, Wilmington was ranked the number one violent small city in the United States. And I think that was among youth, and I think they classified at 17 to 34. And the murder rate in Wilmington at one point was approaching 40 per 100,000. And what people don't know is that you have to extrapolate to get to that, because Wilmington doesn't have 100,000 people.
Right.
Right. And so I like to make the comparison to The Wire, right? Mm. So people were enamored with The Wire. The Wire was, homicide rate was similar. But an hour up the road, up 95, the same thing was going on, right? In a different form, a different fashion, but that homicide rate was about the same. So now let's fast forward. Now 36 out of 100,000, that's beyond epidemic. Now where I was, Watts adjacent in Southeast Los Angeles, the homicide rate from the time that my students were born to the time they saw me as ninth graders was 90 per 100,000. And again, you're extrapolating, because you're talking about a good number of them coming from an unincorporated area of Los Angeles, right? Right. So you have to look at it from that point of view. And so I knew coming in that that humanizing pedagogy was very important. And I told my teachers, probably too often than they like to hear, if you think they're going to change in this first year, you're the fools, not them. It's going to take some time. And then that leads back to the piece that I wrote. And there are a lot of details that are not in there, right? Because when I wrote it, there was a lot of details. Like, I'm gonna turn it back to you, because we should have a conversation about that. That's enough. I'm inviting myself back.
All right. Because there's a lot to unpack there. Because what people don't understand is that you can't just talk about schools in a vacuum.
No.
You have to talk about all of the structural racism that is wrapped up in the community that they live in, that creates those conditions. And then you're expecting young people to thrive while living in a community with that kind of murder rate, which hand in hand goes with the fact that that community is high poverty. Mm-hmm. And multiple generations of their families experiencing that. So it's not just the trauma that they experienced from the time they were born to when they were in ninth grade. It's the trauma that their parents have experienced and how that has impacted their ability to parent and even their mm-hmm. ability to help guide their educational process. So all of that comes to your door.
Mm-hmm.
And right. Then here you are, the principal of this school, saying, I'm gonna turn this thing on its head. This is not a building that is about law and order for some uncivilized children. Right. This is about a building that is about restoring the humanity and turning on its head everything that society and this neighborhood has tried to tell them about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And to create a place where they can walk in the doors and know that I'm human, I am loved, I'm appreciated, and I'm seen and I'm valued.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not what people are accustomed to. And quite frankly, when we work in these kinds of communities, people feel like, you know, they're afraid of the children.
Yes.
Which doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. So when you decided that you were going to focus on humanity, how did the students and the families respond? Because that's not something that they're used to.
Right. I have to go back because it's a couple things you hit on. And you spoke of the trauma. The trauma is epigenetic in nature too. So it's passed down.
Yes.
Right? We can look at post-traumatic slave syndrome to tap into that a little bit, Joy DeGruy. And so we have to pay attention to what they experience, right? And then I'll lead to your question. So just to frame it a little bit, if you look at that fourth grade slide that Kunjufu talks about, mm-hmm. if you look at that, right now in 2020, the fourth grade Black males in the United States were born at a time when they were 21 times more likely to be killed by police than white males. So these are your fourth graders now, right? Maybe some third graders, right? And and I mentioned the spirit murdering. And if you add that in, I can't begin to tell you what it is, but it trumps 21 times, right? Mm-hmm. Because we have to respect that. Black males are 2.5 times more likely to be killed by the police now. 13%, to your poverty point, 13% of the American population approximately, but we only own maybe 2.5% of its wealth. We're 5 times more likely to be incarcerated than whites, and well over 40% of the prison population. So when you look at that, all that compounds to, as you said, what shows up at your door. And then what happens with education being an overwhelmingly white space, we expect children to act white. Mm-hmm. Black children don't have that luxury.
Right.
Right? And so that trauma that was acquired at home, a great deal of students see that reignited in the schools.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So how do you begin to create that trust where they begin to understand, you know, Dr. Stewart's not jiving me when he says that this is how he believes that I am, and this is what he believes I can grow into, and that he actually cares about what's going on with my family and all of that, because it requires them to take down a wall mm-hmm. and to really engage with what it is that you're trying to offer in the school.
Mm-hmm. Right. I can give you some concrete examples. I think I had the advantage of being able to move around in the surrounding neighborhood for about a year. And so what I did is, as much as I could, I spent times in the various neighborhoods, meeting people, getting to know people. I found myself mentors, because even though I was from the inner city, you know, Southbridge and then the east side of Wilmington, and I knew a little bit about what's going on, I strongly believe in a local level context, right? Each urban community cannot be painted with these broad brushstrokes. They're right. Nuances. Right. And so I got to know what was going on. Like I said, I got myself mentors, and they taught me what to look out for in those communities, what was important. I asked questions all the time. I just hung out. And I'm talking to my mentors from 17 up. And I just listened and I took it all in. That was the first thing I did. Then what I would do is allow myself to be accessible. So everybody had my number. If you want to share something, let me know, because I'm interested. Then to move forward, what I did was I said, how am I going to stay connected to the community when I have to stay tethered to a school site? So I did something that was outside of that educational model, is that you read about. I hired a community outreach coordinator. That was the magic. Mm-hmm. That was the magic. Because the students that I had met that showed up, like, for example, there were students, I would go to the different middle schools too, and just ask permission to walk around. And I would walk the hallways and I would see kids in the hallway and I'd talk to them. I would ask for an audience with their parents. So putting that work in and them having that contact allowed them to show up. They weren't walking the halls anymore, right? Now, I wasn't perfect, but they weren't walking the halls anymore because they had seen me and they had built somewhat of a relationship when they were eighth graders. But this community outreach coordinator allowed me to keep that connection, right? Because I said, I told her, you do whatever you have to do. And one thing I made sure of was that she was from that community. So she knew the community, like the back of her hand. And so she was the person that allowed me to keep that connection. She always made it clear that wherever she was there on my behalf because I couldn't be there until she didn't have to. They knew that if they couldn't get to me, which wasn't hard, that she was the liaison. All right, she's the person to go to. You go to Miss Berry, shout out Maria Elena Berry. When I met with her and laid out this idea, she took it to heights that I didn't even imagine, you know? So like you saw in the piece, one of the things that she put together that wasn't even on my radar, she put together the biannual health fair. Mm. She did that. So where, you know, people in the community, not only in our school community, but the entire community could come on our campus and get their annual mammogram, right? We had a monthly school-based clinic that I gave up my office for, right? Which was not a big deal because I was never in there, but, you know, I was like, this is a space, boom, you could use it. And I'm looking at the piece right here because I'm not going to remember. Sexual awareness, STD testing, regular eye exams, actually providing corrective lenses, a biannual physical exam if they needed to, dental screenings, grocery programs, clothes drives, utility subsidies, and rent subsidies. She kicked all of that off from us building and talking about what students needed before they could perform academically.
So you really became the community hub.
Yes, that was my goal because my thing was the school needs to be at the center of the community.
Right.
Your school, your mosque, your synagogue, it should be at the temple. It should be at the center of the community.
Yep.
Period. And I was going to hold myself accountable for that. Mm-hmm. And that's why it was important for her to be in place to do that.
So you said something earlier where you said to your staff, if you think they're going to change in a year, then you're the fool and not them, and it's going to take time. Mm-hmm. So how did your staff respond to all of these changes that were happening, which then also required them to shift their attitude and their way of working with young people?
Well, again, I had the advantage of handpicking my staff. Mm. So one thing I did was I made sure I had ample Black males on campus. That was the first thing I did. After that, my goal was Black males, Latinx males, and then I'd go from there and have as many people of color as possible. So that's the first thing I did. So as I built relationships with them, they knew what I expected coming in. And I could always go back to them if I didn't expect anybody to be perfect, but if they ever balked, I could always say, you know what I expect, right? You know what I expect. And I had no shame in telling them, hey, if you don't want to be here, you ain't got to be here. You can leave. Because that's important, right? And no respect lost. So also what we did is we had a week-long professional development. And we did everything that I arranged from a scavenger hunt of the community to meeting with one of the elders of the community that has and still is an advocate and a social justice activist for that community to this day. We met with her to send it over the top. I begged her that we have this meeting at her house. So we had the first day was a day-long professional development at her house. So she allowed us to do that. And that's what set it off. And then from there, monthly, I would do professional developments that were tied to the community. So I would actually have students help me draft those professional development opportunities, and I would have them sit in, and I would have parents sit in also, so they could hear, so to give the community a voice.
So describe for me then what the shift of atmosphere felt like in your school and also in the community as a result of all of this.
The first thing that comes to mind is two examples. I remember walking through the office one day. I was always moving back and forth, and parents used to tease me, like, "You never sit down." I'm moving back and forth. And then one parent stopped me when I came through the office one day. She was a real reluctant parent at first, and then she began to show up. She was in the office helping, send out some flyers or something like that. And she stopped me. And she said, "If I would have known last year that it would have been like this," meaning like it was the warmest environment she had ever been in as a parent, "I would have volunteered from day one." Another example I think about is a parent coming to me frustrated because she could not convince other parents that she had come into contact with that they should attend our school. And she said, "I just gave up. I just gave up." And then I thought, I asked them, "Do you have your principal's phone number?" And they said, "No." She said, "I pulled out my cell phone." I said, "Well, here's mine. You do what you want to do." So those are the things I think about. And that was the tenor after a while. Like, they knew that that space was for them. It wasn't easy because, they would call me out, if there was things they weren't happy with or whatever, but you got to welcome that. So I think those two examples kind of lay it out. One more example. I remember, we can't front like it wasn't violence in the community. There weren't little bubbling ups in the school. I remember one kid, matter of fact, he's been calling me, and we just can't connect for like 2 weeks. But one day, I'm in the hallway, it's passing period, and I just say, "Jay." Jay walks up to me, kind of kicks his foot up on the wall because he doesn't want people to really see him talking to me like that. He kicks his foot up on the wall. He doesn't look at me. He says, "Yo, Stuart, just want to let you know, man, there was some things going on, but I handled that for you. So don't even worry about it." And then he just left and went to class. So that was the environment that it developed, because we had to build that trust. You know what I mean? For him to put his rep on the line to shut some things down. So this is a couple examples on how the atmosphere changed, definitely.
So in the piece, you talked about the fact that there was sheriff presence in the school. How did you manage that, and how did you lay the expectations?
Well, it was something that, so just so to make it clear, because I know some people might say, "Well, how do you have the advantage to move around for a year? How do you have, hire your own people at first? How did you do that?" So this is a charter school that served the community, right? So you couldn't come from everywhere. You had to live in the community to know that we needed the right sheriff on campus. And then, and then I want to do some framing, but we understood why we wanted that person's presence. So, and I know me and another two in particular were like, "No, we don't want the presence of that sheriff from." First of all, we don't want too many. And then we don't want that presence of one or two sheriffs on campus for what's happening on campus. We want that presence based on what we know is happening outside of the school gate. Let's make that clear, right? And I know some people may disagree, but I would not give up that sheriff, right? And I'll tell you why. And I know I'm jumping, but then I'm going to go back to your last question about how the environment changed. We got a tip. I can't remember who it was, but somebody got a tip, and they came and told me that one of our ninth graders that was, into a little stuff was gonna have some people show up to take care of him after school. So okay, we got that. So I let those males know on my campus, hey, meet me at the gate prior to school being out. We'll make sure your class is covered for those last few minutes because this is what's happening. I won't mention a particular gang, but as soon as I unlocked that gate and all us brothers showed up, it was about 3 car full of cats right at the gate. We squashed that, right? Because we understood. So we didn't relay that to the sheriff right away because I had the opportunity to earn their respect at that point, right? And then when you take that chance, what happens is what happened, right? Whatever their beef was, I didn't say don't have beef. Don't beef here.
Right.
Because I can't tell them what to do. They never show back up. Because it was all respect. So that's why I wouldn't give up that sheriff, because sometimes you can't be everywhere at once. Sometimes you don't get that tip, right? And then you have to make it clear what I mentioned about the reframing is we have to ask ourselves these questions, like, what are we afraid of? Why do we feel we need protection? You know, as I mentioned, alluded to earlier, are we protecting ourselves from outside factors or inside factors, right? Inside factors. And then once we do that, we have to ask ourselves, who protects us from our protectors?
Mm.
So you have to have the courage enough to dictate to the folks that you bring in, nah, you're going to do it the way we want it done, right? And then we have to ask ourselves, is this presence on campus of school resource officers or school police or whatever, is it a function of the needs of the dominant class? We gotta ask that question, right? So I hope I got to where you were going, but those are the questions we have to ask ourselves, mm-hmm. which took it right back to how we dealt with our sheriff on the campus.
And how did you integrate the community into those conversations? Because there also has to be a level of trust, because the parents also have to understand that the function of the sheriff is not to penalize their children, but to protect from outside elements. So how did you get to that part?
Again, the community outreach coordinator. And then it was me, there was about 4 of us that consistently went out into the community, and we would go after school, and we'd pick an area and we visit some folks. And so again, it was just building that trust. And so once they knew who we were, they would go over with whatever we said, right? It doesn't mean that they didn't question, but you know, at least if they question, we usually wind up to, okay, if you say it's cool, it's cool.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So, I mean, it's just really about those relationships. That's what it's really about. It's really about those relationships. And also what I did with, if you go back to the piece, and which would really help us, and this goes back, the idea of a care syndrome goes back to West Africa and communities being related, so nobody ever went without. Everybody was always supported and taken care of. The same thing happened with the migration of Latinx folks into East Los Angeles. The Mutualistas grew out of that. And that's the same thing as a care syndrome that grew out of West Africa. So what we did was we put parents in the groups. Now I'm not going to front like every parent bought in, but if there was information to share, we could share that in groups and they knew who to reach out to and they could reach across groups if somebody within their group didn't have the information that they needed. So that was one way too, because I mean, we know you go to the school and you don't have a relationship with other parents,
no.
You know, or faculty or staff, you don't. And so that's huge. Simply building a trusting relationship.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I'm still thinking about all the questions that you were posing, as we talked about what is really the purpose of having a sheriff or school resource officer on campus, and the probing questions that as educators you need to ask yourself before you even allow that person onto the campus, and you dictating their function instead of them dictating their function. So what advice would you give to educators who are really trying to come to a new place about how they manage discipline on campus, how they manage their school resource officers? You know, because some of these school districts are just throwing resource officers out of the building, you know? And folks are still saying, well, that's not the answer either, because we haven't come up with a new way of dealing with safety and accountability on our campus. So how do you think people should begin to approach that so that there's balance?
So I gotta go back to Neely Fuller and him talking about how racism, white supremacy rules 9 areas of people activity. And I can give you all 9 if you want, but the first one was education. Or maybe economics, because you always listen alphabetical. So economics, education, entertainment, labor law, politics, religion, sex, war. So education is one of those branches of racism, white supremacy. So as I mentioned before, we never acknowledge how racism is institutionalized to the point that it breeds and maintains violence, whether the physical or the spiritual, right? So that's the first thing. And I agree, just throwing resource officers out, that's not the answer. Because really, the biggest problem in most cases is not the resource officers. It's the system within which they act. So the same with police. They're part of a system, right? And so, and more often than not, a resource officer, a school police officer, sheriff, whoever, that commits some heinous act is usually that one-off individual that, you know, but they're still acting within a system. So my advice would be professional development for your staff. Now, as an instructional leader, you can't fake the funk. You have to be immersed in these practices also, right? A culturally sustaining pedagogy, which is, you know, your culturally responsive pedagogy blended with understanding the funds of knowledge or the sources of capital that students bring to school with them, the creative genius that all of our students possess, right? In particular, Black students. And then constantly having the courage to hold people accountable for how they treat students. Now, one thing that needs to happen, one thing that needs to happen is that, because I have to mention teacher preparation, because that's what I do, but teacher preparation and then professional development programs within schools have to allow or require, I'm just conceptualizing, is the overwhelmingly white teacher force to self-excavate. They have to understand how their positionality biases their epistemology, how it influences their view of the world. If they never do that, you can have as many school resource officers as you want, or as few to zero. And guess what? Those students are still going to be spirit murdered, because those are the individuals they have the greatest contact with, right? So I really think that what needs to be done is, in a therapeutic sense, teachers need therapy, right? Because you can't really buy into what needs to be done to properly support students if you don't deal with your own stuff first, right? And so often what happens in an assimilation respect of racism, you know, teachers counterpunch with their white emotionalities or their white fragility in order to defend their acts or what have you, or to condemn the acts of others in an era of attribution. So in a real therapeutic sense, like, they need to go through therapy, right? They need to go through therapy. Again, going back to post-traumatic slave syndrome, what I like about that is she talks about, Dr. Joy talks about all of us needing therapy after this peculiar institution ended and none of us got it, right? And the thing is that this may be strong for some people saying that white teachers need therapy, right? But we don't want to lose our teaching core. We just want them to be better. They have to understand that many of their students, the trauma is a direct result of oppressive systems. And with education being one of those, if you don't fight that racism or confront that racism within yourself, you're still perpetuating that system, right? So to be sure, white teachers have a different task. Many of them must first win the fight regarding racism within themselves, right? Teachers of color, right? Because I'm really not talking about black teachers only. I'm to all teachers of color, because black kids come and have all these teachers.
Right.
Must fight the internalization of the message that spirit murdering sends. Because sometimes we police ourselves because we buy into the fact that we should be denied
right
certain things. Also, there's a lot of talk of anti-racism right now, right? But it's not reading a book. It's a way of life, right? It's a way of life, definitely a way of life. I would point people specifically to one I can't remember, Sean Jenright's work on hope and healing.
Yes.
Yeah, so you're familiar. Awesome.
We actually partner with Sean on a number of projects. Yeah.
Yes. You know what I mean? So centering healing.
Yes.
Right? And that's the book. I can't remember. I know it's Hope and Healing. I can't remember the subtitle. And then the Racial Healing Handbook is a good one too. Annalise Singh. These are just things to ground these teachers in praxis. Because I said, it's not about reading a book, but yet I'm giving you books. But you have to read to inform your practice.
Right.
Right? So again, it's a way of life. Because, and the reason why I say everybody needs to center healing, I think it was Ibram Kendi who said this, but the only thing wrong with black people is that they think there's something wrong with black people. Mm-hmm. And the only thing wrong with white people is that they think nothing's wrong with white people.
Yeah. He said that in the book, How to Be an Anti-Racist.
So there you go. Yeah. Right? That's just one part, but I hope we got to where you were going.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think the way that you structured professional development that you talked about earlier is critical because, mm-hmm. you know, so much of what is done in professional development is, you know, stuff that we buy from, you know, these big organizations that profess to be great at, you know, PD. Mm-hmm. Etc. And even, you know, some of the national things around race that are not grounded in local reality and not grounded in local mm-hmm. truth. Mm-hmm. And so your description of your approach to professional development and centering young people in terms of having them to actually write some of the professional development is critical because mm-hmm. we need our teachers to understand and see the humanity of the young people that walk in the halls every single day, you right. know, and if they understand the history of the community and they understand and are challenged in terms of the way they have previously thought about the community mm-hmm. and hand in hand with that, they begin to know the stories of the young people that they teach every day, it creates a whole different learning environment. Mm-hmm. And they also have to become vulnerable enough to own the fact that they had these struggles and to be able to state them so that young people can see them say, yes, I know I was wrong, but I'm trying a new way. Can mm-hmm. we do some of this hand in hand together?
Mm-hmm. Because students, their families and their communities, they're ethnographers, they're mm-hmm. anthropologists, they're historians, right? And so I recommend my teachers to, just like I did, get you a mentor. Start with your students first and then ask them, who else can I get to mentor me so I understand how to best serve you? Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, do you do any work advising school administrators as they are attempting to do this work in their communities?
I have. I do so formally a little bit, but folks who know me will reach out mm-hmm. and they'll ask me to work with their principals or assistant principals. And it's, you know, usually based on, I was going to say lore, but based on things they've heard about what I've done, they'll call me and ask me to help their principals out. I'll even go in and model professional development for their principals. Yeah, I've done that. But I usually do that all like for free, just because it's important for the community to do it mm-hmm. Or the community to be served properly. And then, you know, and I want them to be successful, because part of the reason why, and you didn't ask me this, but part of the reason why, I won't say I'll never be an administrator again, but why I left, if you will, because there's a bottom line that governs each business, all right? And education is a business. I didn't care about the bottom line, right? We'll get to the bottom line once our students feel safe, once we build the type of reputation that they want to be here, once we go through enough cohorts where we begin to offset some of the generational trauma that has had, because they've had this intimate relationship with education that has been violent. So, you know, I'm gonna leave that alone. But, you know, because some people would have a problem, but, you know, I don't care. It's not about their GPA at first. It's mm-hmm. not about that. Like, if they don't feel, some students come in and they're teacher proof with their trauma, but that's very few, very few. You got to worry about how they feel first. It has to be really holistic.
Yeah. No, I think you make a good point, you know, because one of the things that we struggle with in this work is that funders, or, you know, if you're operating within a system and that system is government funded, et cetera, there are certain markers that you have to meet. They're looking at graduation rates, they're looking at GPA, mm-hmm. and your funding is tied to all of that. Mm-hmm. But what we have been trying to unearth for people with Forward Promise is there are some incremental markers along the way that are far more important, that if you address the issues around trauma and you understand that it's connected to their ability to show up in the classroom, it's connected to their ability to get a good night's sleep before they can even walk in the building the next day. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're addressing issues like hunger, et cetera, that are happening outside of the building, but that are all impacting their ability to be successful, we'll get to GPA and we'll get to high school graduation rates and we'll mm-hmm. get to college going rates later. But those are not the initial outcomes to be tracked and measured.
No.
And that it requires us to build a different kind of understanding, and for people to begin to understand concepts like the ones that you shared today, so that they begin to understand, like, there's layers to this, and you have to get to those initial layers before we can get to these outcomes that you all are measuring as important.
Yeah, and we have the unfortunate responsibility of undoing what a system has done to us before we can get to all those measures. Mm-hmm. And all those
outcomes. Even those outcomes operate within a system of white supremacy.
Mm-hmm.
So, man, this has been an amazing conversation. And yes, you have been invited back. So we're going to figure out when we can do this again. I did want to lift up for folks the other book, the one that you wrote, Thoughts of a Ghetto Scatterbrain, the EP.
Yes.
And for folks who are listening to today's episode, posted in the resource section of the podcast description will be a link to Dr. Stewart's book, as well as a link to the initial book that we mentioned, Transforming Practices in Urban Education, that Dr. Stewart has a chapter in. So I just want to thank you for taking the time, for sharing knowledge with us today. Keep doing what you're doing, as I know that you will. And clearly the young people whose lives you are touching and the community that they live in are better for it. And I want us to stay connected and keep talking, because there are a lot of issues related to systemic change in education that need to be unearthed for people. so that we can increase understanding, but ultimately so that we can push for action.
Most definitely. I'm always ready to brainstorm. You know, I just want, I don't like the word success too much, but I want the success that I know our students deserve. I'm always ready. I'm down.
Cool. We will make that happen. Thank you so much.
Definitely. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Heal, Grow, Thrive, the podcast. We hope these conversations prompt a deeper commitment to action in the field and in philanthropy to create a society that is fair and equitable for all. For more information about Forward Promise, visit forwardpromise.org or follow us on social media. We're simply Forward Promise on Facebook and @forward_promise on Twitter and Instagram.